This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. Tailgates with crowds of old college friends slinging beer and burgers are staples of fall in North Carolina. But the normal rituals that mark the start of college sports will look different this year. The ACC recently announced plans to bump back college football, with the first games happening the second week of September. But is it possible to play safely in the middle of a pandemic? Joining me now is Rachel Jones. She's a junior midfielder for the UNC Chapel Hill women's soccer team. Rachel, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So take me back to the beginning of this pandemic. You and your team were still on UNC's campus when everything started to really change. I'm curious about what that moment was like for you and the rest of the UNC women's soccer team.
Yeah, so I think the week that everything sort of changed in the world, where we realized that this pandemic was really serious, is when the NBA started canceling. And for us, we were supposed to go to England for spring break that Friday. And at practice the Wednesday before, we had a team meeting, and our head coach Anson brought us all together and said, "We're actually not going to go to England anymore. You can go home, do whatever you want on spring break, and we'll come back after spring break and finish out the season as planned." Because usually in spring season, we have our games spread out throughout the whole time, but this time we put them all to the end. Mm. So we were supposed to play all of our games the weekends following until the end of the semester. So then we went home for spring break, and halfway through spring break, we got an email from the university telling us not to even come back and that the rest of the semester would be online and that our spring season was canceled and that we wouldn't have any games. So we haven't played in a real game since the national championship in December.
Wow. So what did that mean for you? And I mean, obviously it shook all of us in many ways, but for someone who's so used to playing with a team and a team that was excited to play all of those games, what did that mean for y'all?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was really weird because it was sort of like we were all pushing ourselves mentally through those first 2 months of spring season to get to the games. And we were like, okay, we got through the hard part. Now we get to do the fun stuff and playing games again. And then that got taken away from us. And it was really sad. And then also having to adjust to training on our own for 2 months. And then added on that, a lot of people's fields around their houses were closed. So we had to figure out how to train in our backyards and stuff like that. So it was a really big transition.
What are some of the creative things that you all did to be able to train while you were at home, away from all of the normal, fields and things you need to practice?
The main thing that our team did was wall workouts. So all you basically need is a soccer ball and a wall where you have, like, different drills that you'll do against the wall. So you'll pass it, and then one time you'll take a touch with your right foot and then pass it back and that type of stuff. Since you didn't have any partners, you really had to figure out a way to get somebody to pass the ball back to you instead of just passing it on your own.
So you all were finally allowed to come back to campus last month, and I'm curious about what that transition was like for you in terms of safety and then the logistics of beginning to train and play together again.
Yeah, so we all came back June 29th, and we had to do a 2-week mandatory quarantine before we got tested for the first time on July 13th. So then after everybody got negative results from that, then we were allowed to start training within our houses. So we're only allowed to train with up to 4 people for that week. And then we got tested again the next Monday. And then once we got those negative results back was when we're allowed to do up to groups of 10. So we're still in like a bubble with just our team. We can't see anybody else. So it's definitely different than what it usually is like in the summer here.
What's the plan for when other students come back and you all aren't going to really be able to keep that bubble in the same way?
So some of us have all online classes like I do, so it's really easy for me to not be able to see anybody outside of the team. But some people do have like 1 or 2 classes that are still in person, which that could still change within the next week. But I know that all the classes that we have that are in person are going to be in big classrooms where you can still be 6 feet apart and you have to wear masks during it. So that makes us a little bit more comfortable.
I want to bring in one more guest to the conversation now. Joining us is sports columnist Luke DeCock. He works for the News and Observer. Luke, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as we said earlier, the ACC decided to move the start of football season back to the second week of September. So talk about that decision and what it means to start the competition season a bit later.
Everyone's kind of feeling their way through this, whether it's the ACC or professional sports or even youth sports. And no one really knows what it's going to be like for athletes like Rachel and like football players when there are other students back on campus and back in places like Chapel Hill, whether they're living on campus or not. And we've seen from pro sports like Major League Baseball right now that if you're not in a self-contained bubble the way that the NWSL was able to do in MLS and now the NHL and NBA, if you don't have that self-contained environment, it's very difficult to play and travel without encountering outbreaks of COVID-19. So the ACC is kind of buying time here. Fall practice for football officially is supposed to start, depending on the school, anywhere from today to next week. And they want to get a sense of what it's going to be like as students start to get back on campus. And no one wants to kind of say, we can't do this now. And the metaphor I use is it's like going down a staircase. You're not going to jump to the bottom all at once. You're going to go step by step. And what everyone wants to do, because there's, not in a greedy sense, but football is the lifeblood of athletic departments and funds a lot of other sports because it brings in so much money. Everyone really wants to play some kind of a season to make sure that TV money keeps coming in. And no one wants to jump to any conclusions. So you're kind of moving through these intuitions, trying to salvage as much of the season as they can. The ACC said this week it would play 10 conference games and one non-conference game and push the start of the season back to mid-September. And that's hoping they can buy enough time to really kind of reckon with this and figure out whether or not they can do this safely at a time when, quite honestly, most schools have decided that, it's not entirely safe to have students on campus like normal. You've got to figure out a way whether you can keep athletes safe.
So what are the protocols for testing? Because even if, say, we're able to keep athletes in bubbles, which, is going to be really challenging once other people come onto campus, they're going to be bringing teams together from various places around the country. So what are the plans that they have for testing and preparation for these games to make sure that they're as safe as possible?
For football, and that's the protocol that the ACC has really specified so far, it's roughly weekly testing, 3 days ahead of competition. And the idea is that you can kind of clear everybody and then keep them in a, in a bubble until the game, so let's say sort of the Wednesday, Thursday through Saturday kind of bubble. And then players, staff who will be in contact with players. And that's an enormous number of people and an enormous number of tests because, there are so many players on a football roster and there is so much of a support staff, everything from, medical and athletic training to media relations, equipment, to the coaches themselves. And we've all seen sort of the bloat with football coaching staff. So that's a lot of tests, a lot of ways for an infection to get in and transmit within a team in that period between a game and the testing. Students are, we are talking about college kids. This is not going to be an inviolable bubble. Even the NBA hasn't been able to do that. So that's the protocol. There's been some criticism of it from some epidemiologists. But that's kind of what the ACC has decided makes the most sense from a financial perspective, just in terms of testing costs, and then from a safety perspective in terms of trying to make sure it can identify and stop an outbreak before it gets bad.
So, Rachel, how do you feel about the testing protocol that has been released? Does that make you feel safe to play a game with a team coming from somewhere else?
Yeah, I think now that they have set that protocol, everybody feels a lot more comfortable because before they didn't really say for sure that we were going to get tested. It was sort of like each school, you have your own rules and figure it out. But now that they said that, I know that our team feels a lot more comfortable knowing that the other schools are also going to get tested before and hopefully we'll be in a similar bubble to what we have.
What conversations are happening among athletes about these rules in terms of keeping the bubble? Because you all are not, this isn't your professional job. You're also students. You're also in college. So, I mean, is it going to be tough to get everyone on board with this protocol and really maintaining and keeping people in isolation and bubbles and all of that?
I think it really depends on the team. Like for us, with the way that our past two seasons ended, losing a national championship, our whole team is bought into the idea of doing whatever possible to be able to play again and to hopefully get another chance at a national championship. So for us, it isn't as difficult to get people to buy in, but for teams like basketball, for example, where their first game isn't until December, but they're expected to live in these bubbles and not see anybody else for such a long period of time before you even step on the court, I think it's much more difficult to have that incentive to really listen to every single rule.
I want to talk a bit about funding. Luke, you mentioned, obviously, we know that television revenue from football is the primary funder behind a lot of college athletic programs. So it's really important for these schools to be able to have the competitions happen. We know that earlier on, due to funding depletion that already happened in the spring, some programs have been cut. So I want to hear a clip now from the associate head coach of swimming and diving at ECU. That program was cut back in May.
The day that the program was cut will certainly be a day that they probably never forget. You know, these kids, a lot of them considered the team to be their family, and they were essentially ripped away from that over a Zoom call. As I look to the future and, you know, my next landing spot, one of my biggest questions is going to be, how safe is the program?
That was former associate head coach of swimming and diving at ECU, Kate Moore. The men's and women's swimming and diving programs at ECU were cut in May. So, Luke, talk about that. Talk about the landscape of canceled programs at North Carolina schools. What do we know about who is cutting teams and what's leading them to do this?
Carolina cut men's swimming and men's and women's tennis. Appalachian State cut a few sports. ECU itself is a bit of a unique case because they're dealing with an athletic department that's been running a massive deficit, in part, you know, to bring us full circle, because the football team went through a period where it was completely non-competitive. And that hurt communications and ticket sales, and they'd embarked on a massive expansion of the football stadium that they then couldn't pay for. You know, there's some evidence, if you talk to sports economists who study this kind of thing, that a program like men's tennis or women's tennis or swimming and diving, where a lot of the athletes are on very small partial scholarships, it's not a full scholarship sport the way that football or basketball is, that sports like those actually bring in more tuition revenue for the university than is spent by the athletic department playing those sports. And in the case of swimming and diving at East Carolina, where there were a lot of foreign students paying very high tuition rates, out-of-state tuition, that there's some evidence that, you know, East Carolina's counter-argument was that the facilities needed investment and they had to correct this deficit somehow. But what the coronavirus pandemic has done in some cases is, you know, for a school like Winthrop, which cut its tennis program, it's created an opportunity for schools to cut sports and that the pandemic as a PR shield, quite frankly. The issue with college sports finances in general, and this is true everywhere, is the arms race in terms of facilities, in terms of coaching salaries, in terms of support salaries, has created such a bloated overhead, you know, $1 million strength coaches and all this money spent on facilities, because there was so much money coming in, and no one ever thought that the spigot would get cut off, which now it has. You know, even if there's football television revenue coming in, very unlikely these games are going to be played in front of fans. And that's a lot of ticket revenue that won't be coming in. There is sort of a financial reckoning going on in college athletics, where schools that have been living, quite frankly, high on the hog for a long time are now facing some very difficult financial decisions. And of course, it's administrators or coaches whose salaries get cut. It's, you know, entire sports and opportunities for athletes.
So, Rachel, I mean, obviously there are the financial consequences of seasons being cut, but say you all are not able to play this fall, what would that mean for the team?
Well, for us, our seniors would probably all go pro instead of, even if the NCAA were to give an additional year of eligibility like they did with the spring sports, they would all leave, because how we do it is we plan to graduate the fall of our senior year, because the draft is typically that January right after. So they would all leave, which would be devastating, because this is an extremely good senior class that we have that everybody almost has a really good relationship with. So losing out on another year playing with them would be very, very difficult.
What are the kinds of conversations that are happening among your team now about kind of how to brace yourselves for the fall and all of the upcoming decisions?
Yeah, I think we're really just focusing on being flexible and just taking every day as it comes, because as we learned in the spring, you can think that you're going to play a game on Thursday and actually on Wednesday your entire season gets canceled. So we're all just thinking about enjoying every moment that we have together because we don't know when everything could get cut for us. So I think that's the main thing. And then also just when we do start playing games, I think ACC said it's only going to be 6 games overall, which is like half of what we usually do. So I think the important thing is just to focus on each game individually instead of making it feel like it's a lot more, because then you could get added pressure. So I think just, like I said, focusing on each day and taking everything as it comes.
Luke, in your opinion, as a sports columnist and someone who follows this all really closely, do you think that schools can allow these sports to happen safely this fall?
I think that's very doubtful that they're going to be able to pull this off. And again, I would point to Major League Baseball, which has, you know, significant resources and has invested heavily in a plan to try to play not in a specific site, but at home stadiums, and hasn't been able to do it. You know, teams have been shut down. Baseball's going to have a very difficult time finishing its season this summer. And I think there's also generally, you know, nationally, both among people in the college sports world and lay people, you know, there's an underestimation of what the risks are. You know, you're basically, the chances of a young, healthy athlete dying or becoming seriously ill from this disease are small, but they're not zero. And, you know, for elite athletes, people who, you know, like Rachel's teammates and Rachel, who may be going on to professional sports, you could get this, be asymptomatic, and experience long-term, you know, physical damage to your lungs, to your heart, that could compromise your pro career. And that might not be the case if you weren't on campus, you know, being exposed to some of these risks. And that, obviously, for athletes, that's a question that they have to accept, to assess and determine what level of risk that they can accept. But I do think there could be a point with football and with other sports where it becomes clear as students get back to campus that you can't maintain a level of safety, maintain an acceptable level of risk. And, you know, I think that has to be the priority more so than, you know, we have to look at what the potential consequences are, and not just for athletes, but for coaches. Some of these coaches are in high risk groups. You know, there are athletes who may have pre-existing conditions that put them in high risk groups. And, you know, the ACC has yet to announce a policy. It looks like it's going to be school by school of what to do with athlete scholarships if they choose not to play. You know, some schools may honor those scholarships. Some schools may not.
Rachel, I want to close out with you. You're in this interesting position right now. You are a student representative and you go to these NCAA meetings and you're trying to be a part of the conversation. What advice do you have to other student athletes around the country who are in a similar situation like you?
Yeah, I would say not necessarily focus on doing everything that you have to do just to have a season, but also to keep everybody just in your community safe, because if you're not listening to the bubble and you're going out and you're bringing things back into your team, and say your older coach gets sick who's high risk, like, there could be dire consequences to all of this. So I think a lot of this isn't really in our control, but what we do with staying in the bubble and wearing masks, washing our hands frequently, we can control all of that. So doing whatever you can to control, doing whatever you can to mitigate the risk yourself is basically all we can do right now, I think.
Rachel Jones is a junior midfielder for the UNC women's soccer team, as well as a member of the NCAA Student Athlete Advisory Committee. Rachel, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Luke DeCock is a sports columnist with the News and Observer. You can find links to his columns at our website, stateofthings.org. Luke, thank you as well.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.